Welcome to the Passive House podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your technical questions answered, and contribute to the community forum. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our construction tech or weekly global Passive House showcase webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast. Kia ora, tēnā koutou katoa. It's Matthew Cutler-Welsh here coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland in New Zealand.
And this is Zach Semke coming to you from Seattle, Washington.
It's a pretty wet day here in Auckland. We've had a deluge of rain just in the last, it feels like it's been raining for a whole week. It is warm though, as we're well into spring now, nearly into officially summer. How are things in Seattle? Cooling down?
They are cooling down. So we had a record-breaking dry spell for us in November. So Seattle and dry and November are words that don't usually come together. Yeah. But I think we had 15 days. Anyway, it broke a record. And so it's been very clear and cold here, hovering around freezing overnight. But that just broke yesterday. We had a lot of rain yesterday. So that's good news. Although it's, back to dark and dreary for Seattle, but I'll take it.
Good time for a big feast with
that's family. Right. Yeah. In the US we have Thanksgiving coming up and, Indigenous Peoples Day coming up the next day. Thanksgiving is an interesting holiday. It's very complicated. I have very fond feelings about it based on just, family gatherings over the years. But when you look back at the history of it and the whole story, it's a little grim. So,
yeah.
So it's one of those, but I'm really looking forward to, being with, my family and enjoying a bunch of food. And we will pick up the turkey today and brine it overnight and hopefully it'll be tasty.
Nice. All right. Well, we got an interview to go over today, and also a bit of news out of New Zealand, actually. But before we get into that, let's say hello to some sponsors.
Yeah, absolutely. So a big thank you to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Baxt Inquy Architects, Glavel Foam Glass Gravel, Minotaur All-in-One HVAC and Dehumidification Units, Mitsubishi Electric Train HVAC US, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Thanks too to our champion sponsors, Icon Windows and Doors, Intelligent Membranes, Prosico, and Source 2050. And a big thank you to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority.
Awesome. Well, a lot of people will have heard about the TV show Grand Designs, originally from the UK, and which is quite famous, and still a big favourite of that original show, hosted by Kevin MacLeod. There, from that, have sprouted a few other versions of the Grand Designs. And we have our own one here in New Zealand. We've got Grand Design New Zealand. There's also Grand Designs Australia. It's the same format, same franchise, but presented by local architects in both countries. And we're actually into season 7 now in New Zealand. Didn't realize it would be going for so long. But this year, the show has greeted a new host, which is quite exciting. And all over social media, at least in my feeds this week, it's been hard to miss the this week's episode, which featured a Passive House. I'm not sure if it's the first time that a Passive House has been on the show, or at least a designer that's done an airtight design and sort of gone towards the passive house or mentioned passive house. I think it is the first one in New Zealand where it's followed the journey of a designer who is using this project as part of their pathway to become a certified passive house designer. So you can either sit an exam in the PHI, or you can actually submit a project, and that is essentially your assessment. So you kind of get two for one. Where you, if the house passes, you get that house to be certified, and you can also become a designer in that, during that process as well. And so pretty cool story. And I mean, that's a good story in itself, but I think what makes this interesting for me is its newsworthiness in general media. So primetime TV show, that's good. But then it also gets picked up by a lot of the mainstream media, sort of the what used to be newspapers, but now it's online. So some of our bigger media sites are covering it and writing up big stories, going through the whole process and talking about all of the trials and tribulations of just a general house build, but adding the passive house elements on top of that. So it's a great story for a whole bunch of reasons, but I always really like seeing certified passive homes being presented to everyone and not just people like us who are sort of passive house geeks.
It's exciting, and it's a really beautiful project, which I guess is probably a prerequisite to be on the program, but it's very
design,
striking.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, it is cool. It's cool seeing something a little bit different, a little bit unique, and definitely not a square box with small windows.
Yeah, that's right.
And in an area, I mean, Featherston is not always spoken of favorably as a desirable place to live, but there's a little bit in the article which I'll post a link to that it's a bit of a hidden gem, which a lot of regional places are, and I think a lot of people are exploring opportunities to move away from ridiculous real estate markets like in the center of Auckland, where it is unaffordable for the vast majority of people. But to build a higher quality life and a higher quality home in a more affordable area. And this is a great example of that.
It's definitely not, you know, some big ostentatious house. It's just really well designed and very interesting.
Cool. I mean, even from the pictures, it looks very desirable. And then there's lots of explanation about how comfortable it is inside, and also closing off the article, the reference back to how sad it is that there are so many people that just simply can't afford to heat their homes and live in much worse conditions, kind of unnecessarily. So it is beautiful, and it's very welcoming, but it's a big contrast to so many other houses that we have and are still continuing to build. Well, speaking of good designs that are aesthetically pleasing, I think that's a good intro to your guest this week.
Indeed. So we have an interview with Lauren Thompson, the principal and owner of Lauren Thompson Design, based in Philadelphia. And Lauren was the project team for the Northern Liberties Passive House. Northern Liberties is a neighborhood in Philadelphia. We're on Passive House Accelerator Live recently, so we'll include a link to the video of that presentation so you folks can really get a deep dive into this cool project. But Lauren talks about that project. She also talks about her early interest in architecture, her background in fine arts, and then we get into, I think, a really interesting set of insights from her about how passive house practice is impacting her as a designer and as an architect. So I hope everyone enjoys the chat. Well, I have Lauren Thompson here of Lauren Thompson Design, based in Philadelphia. Welcome to the PassFast podcast.
Thank you, Zach. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. We were just reflecting and reminiscing about the presentation that you and your team made for the Passive House Accelerator Live Project Showcase on, I think it was June 15th, of the Northern Liberties Passive Row House. So it's I'm looking forward to diving into that project a little bit for listeners in a moment here. Maybe we could just talk a little bit about what got you into design in the first place, and as a way of kind of laying the foundation for your Passive House story here.
Sure. We moved when I was 7, and I have been designing houses ever since.
Oh, wow.
Honestly, I have a portfolio of of houses that I drew, you know, as a kid. I think it just so happened that, you know, I think I was naturally kind of drawn to architecture. My father's an engineer. My mom is a kind of a graphic designer and artist. And I think I was naturally drawn to it and just happened to be at that age where it really piqued my interest moving. And I would kind of place myself in all of these homes.
Right.
And I became really interested in homes ever, you know, since that moment. And it's funny, now I have a 7-year-old and she's kind of interested in, you know, I'm like, is this going to stick?
Right. Right.
Will be
the second generation of, early architects.
I'll convince her to be an engineer or something.
Yeah, right. Right. Now that you know the reality.
Exactly. Something not quite as demanding of your time. No, but I've just always known. I've always been interested in architecture. And I took a pretty roundabout way of getting there. I actually didn't go to undergraduate school for architecture. I did liberal arts. I went and lived abroad in France for a couple of years. And nice. And
where in France?
I lived in Paris for a year, and then I lived in Poitou-Charentes, which is like the southwest, is like nice. Goat town.
Yeah, right.
It was really wonderful. I taught English, and I probably wouldn't have come home, but not for student loans and and my parents saying, come on, time to get a job. But I always had an artistic got a degree in art and art history, and had a good portfolio of work actually. And so I was lucky and got hired by an architect because the economy was great at that time.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Just as like an intern.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just as help. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of years of that, it became, you know, I knew that I needed to go back to school for a degree in architecture. And but that was really, those years before architecture school were actually really formative for me because I worked for an architect and then also for a contractor who did a lot of adaptive reuse out in Pennsylvania, like kind of west of the city. And I spent a lot of time in the field. I actually got my LEED certification at that time and just really realized that that was the career, you know, this is exactly what I want to be doing. And then I went back to school and lived in upstate New York for a while. And then moved back to Philadelphia where I grew up and started my own firm in 2017.
Right.
Yeah.
And can you describe the kinds of projects that your firm has been doing since then?
Sure. Yeah. It's largely residential with some mixed use and multifamily. But we really are kind of dedicated to well-crafted, I'll say. Like we're really details oriented, both in terms of the design and the performance.
Yeah. Yeah.
but we do both single and multifamily, but really love the kind of single family. We do large scale renovations of historic row homes. We do adaptive reuse, and we also do some new construction, but the row homes tend to be kind of all consuming because they're really challenging and fascinating projects that just kind of unfold, and they're, you have to be strategic in how you document them, and they're really fun. Yeah.
Lots of improvisation, I would imagine, with, with the row homes.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you really don't know what you're dealing with until you've done the demo.
Yeah.
Which the same with any renovation and, you know, and or adaptive reuse. But it's, you know, when they're going on 200 years old, it's a serious learning affair.
Yeah, no doubt.
This is different construction methods, you know. So so that's exciting. And we always try and bring a baseline of high performance to our work, you know, always building above code. And increasingly we've got clients who are interested in that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a nice kind of congruence probably with your focus on craft and details, right? I mean, both for builders and for architects, that's, I think, one of the things that's really attractive, can be attractive about Passive House, is that it does require this detail, this focus on details, and that's where the devil is, as they say. So, I mean, you have this really varied, a really interesting journey from fine art into architecture, some introduction to sustainable design through LEED, I imagine, and then this high performance world, and then Passive House. So how did that last kind of piece, how did you discover Passive House? How does that become part of your practice?
I knew about it back in like 2005 when I was doing the LEED certification, but I think it was much younger then.
Early days. Yeah.
And going back to school, and I remember learning about it. And I actually even learned about it living in France, because it was over there, you know, the high performance building was over there. And I remember touring one home, which was, and I remember them saying, oh, it's airtight. And I was just like, whoa.
Yeah, right.
But, so I've always kind of, you know, felt a responsibility to do the right thing, and believe that as architects, you know, and kind of the given the opportunity to realize big ideas, we need to do it responsibly, or as much as we can. And you know, I think, you know, we are quite literally like building the future.
Right.
So I've always kind of had that interest and inclination in my practice, even before starting a firm. And so been like a curious learner, so to speak, and wanting to know more about it, whether it's, you know, LEED or net zero or Passive House. And so I think I knew about Passive House without going through the process or having direct exposure to the project for quite a few years. And then I learned a little bit more. I taught up at RPI, where I did my master's degree, which is Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. It's up in Troy. Great school. Nice. And there was one colleague of mine, Lon Combs, who he was designing a passive house. And it was really fascinating to me because I kind of I won't say I had stigmatized it, but I had never really seen like a beautifully, like really exquisitely designed Catholic house. And and that's what he was doing in Western Mass. And you know, it was marketable and it was like a wonderful project for him. And so it was neat to see him kind of, you know, and learn about his project as part of his kind of, you know, ongoing practice. And, but he, I think that was his first passive house. I'm not really sure, but he kind of went through the learning process with me, you know, and explained his own learning, you know, and how it's different than typical construction and how you really like, you have to have the right team in place. And so that was interesting to learn and kind of exciting for me because it made it real, so to speak. And then, you know, being approached by Ralph, it was this, which I speak to in the other podcast, it was this confluence of really exciting events where Matt in my office had an opportunity to get certified as a passive house consultant. And then simultaneously, we seemed to have a new client who wanted to do a passive house. And so we were like all in and we were so excited about it. And so that, you know, I kind of went from knowing about it to knowing a little more about it to knowing someone who had experience in designing a passive house and building it and making it real to having, you know, the opportunity to do it in our office. So it's like baby steps, which I'm still, you know, I'm not quite at the crux of it, which is like, it's done. You know, our first one, but we're hopefully doing another, but, you know, it's been a really exciting process and really great learning experience. Like just not only from the, you know, the technical and like the purely design standpoint, but also from, the perspective of like how to manage the team and, you know, the amount of time it takes and, you know, budgetary constraints and kind of the realities of the construction and or supply chain, you know, and the, you know, the realities of completing it, you know.
Right. So, at a challenging moment in the industry, right? Well, this is great. I am eager to dive into this question of passive house and great design. Maybe we can tee that up with your great project. So can we dive into the Northern Liberties Passive Row House project? And would you describe to folks what the project, the essentials of the project, and then I think everyone will be really curious to hear what lessons you're taking away from it.
Sure, absolutely. It's a tiny house on a tiny street. I'll start there.
Right.
And I guess kind of an important element of the context. There are a few, but an important element from the passive house standpoint is that it's an attached home, right? It's not a standalone dwelling. And so it is a row home, although on its southern elevation on the south property line, we don't actually have another home bounding that. We are adjacent to a park, and which is kind of like a beloved community element. We're on a pedestrian street in a very dense area of Philadelphia, so like, you know, concrete trucks are a no-go.
right.
You know, it's like all sorts of logistical challenges that you really can't make up. It's a small home. It's about 1800 square feet total. It does have a garage at the first level, and it's three stories above that, with a small roof deck on the third floor. It's a 3-bedroom home. It's wonderfully dense and small and compact, but it feels really spacious and kind of serene. Based on our finished selections, we imagine it will.
Right.
We're currently in drywall. We've passed all our rough inspections happily.
Nice. What was the number? Do you remember the number?
It wasn't ACH. It was at pressure per square foot of air leakage.
Right.
It was infiltration. 0.038 CFM. So it was pretty good.
Nice.
I think the limit is 0.06. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yes. So Ralph and John were very proud of that. Excited. Yeah. And we are too. We're proud of them. it's a relatively standard row home program, I'll say. But we do have windows on the south facade. We've pulled a portion of the south facade away from the property line to do that. But there are all sorts of, fire rating considerations because we're an attached dwelling, zoning considerations, all sorts of external pressures that kind of informed the design of the building. And it responds to them, I think just kind of by hopefully, being kind of contextually sensitive and, not overly loud, but just nicely designed and, just supporting element in the built environment there.
Yeah, I'm looking at the rendering of the project and it's showing a view of the building with the park on the right, with the trees there, and the material choice is very subtle and natural in terms of the cladding, and the top floor kind of steps back a little bit. It looks like there's a deck up there that and then you can see kind of a little bit of the neighboring row house, and it definitely fits right in there. What you're describing is a lot of that sounds like there are a lot of complex restrictions to the design even before Passive House, and so then you're taking the bull by the horns to go all the way there. What were some of the things that you've learned so far, or that that were particularly challenging, or any aha moments in this process?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting for me to see the details realized. We have got a cavity inside a service cavity inside of our insulated 2x6 wood frame, and the amount of time it took to put the air barrier in, seal the air barrier, and every tape, to get to the service cavity. that was like surprising for me, because we'd stop over, and just be like, wow, they're still at it.
right.
The fact that you actually see it coming and you're like, wow, this is actually kind of like a house inside of a house, right? Mm. So it's just seeing these details actually realize how robust this construction is. Like this home is not going anywhere.
Right.
And you open the door and it's perfectly quiet.
Yeah.
And in the city, that's such a huge thing.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly warm and or tempered, and it's really neat because it's got this like aura about it, which is kind of mystical. Another thing, which is a learning process, is we're going to have a solar array on the roof, and I'm really excited to see how this unfolds, because I have done solar arrays in the past, but not at this scale. And also the project has it's, I'm going to botch this, but it's got a battery. It's got an electric charger. It's got like an intelligent home system. So we're pulling from the panel, and not the grid, kind of intelligently.
Oh, cool. So timing the use. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really neat, that our, you know, the clients have just been all in on investing in this. And then, you know, they're going to be able to monitor that through the smart home system. And, you know, really kind of understand their energy use and use it as an educational tool. So I think that's really exciting, you know, and of course I do that at home, and it's like, it's, to me, it's really important. It's like, you want to see what you're using year after year, or, you know, at the end of a season, you know, how could we do a little better? So I'm excited for them that they're investing in this new technology, and I'm excited to see if it really, you know, if we really are, you know, at net zero, or if, you know, there are moments when we have to pull from the grid, or, you know, if it's a 3.24 kilowatt PV array.
Oh yeah. So it's small.
Yeah.
That's right.
So it's really, so at baseline, the house really doesn't need much, just given the orientation, you know, rows are so efficient. You know, they're insulated on two sides. Mm-hmm. They have very little roof area. They're like, you know, dense little compact homes. The downside of rows is often that they're not super bright. They don't have great daylight. And so in, you know, this project is kind of, got the wonderful opportunity to have that kind of three, orientations of daylight rather than just the two shorter ends. So it's really, I think, like, spatially, it's going to be a really special home. And I'm just so excited to see how, like, see years later how it performs, you know, see if we're cutting mustard.
Yeah, right.
I'm just so excited. I'm sure it'll be great, you know, but it's just, just getting that data to me, like, I'm really excited to have that, you know, and see that. I would love to track the data of all of our projects.
Yep.
That's like an ambitious goal because they're all so similar, or many of them are so similar in scale that we were like, you know, we really could have like a pretty serious database of, you know, energy use versus assembly type versus area versus, you know, size. We really need to have that kind of data and to be able to, you know, do a study, so to speak, of like, you know, how we could do better.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Or what small measures yield.
Right. Right. You know? Well, and it turns these, each project is a proof of concept, and it turns them into such a, so much more powerful one when you actually have the real numbers. And
that makes me want to, I'll get on it.
Well, it'd be great to have a report back of the monitoring results. That'd be really interesting to see. And when, so this is currently, it's pre-certified FIES Plus 2018, right? You got through the blower door test, which is fantastic. When do you anticipate the project being completed?
Hopefully Thanksgiving, maybe Christmas.
Oh, soon.
Wait, so no, really no. Soon. Yeah, that Thanksgiving goal, I think, is
no, no. Yeah, so Christmas, it's almost there. We're talking
the end of the
a couple
year,
few because, months.
Yeah, usually we're 6 weeks after drywall, and these guys.
Okay.
Guys are very organized.
Great.
So yeah, I would say I'd say the end of the year. Looks, I wish I had sent you photographs because we were discussing the exterior materiality. The what is actually there blows, like, this
rendering. Oh yeah, nice. Terrible. Nice. Yeah, I can't wait. Please do send them.
I will. They did a beautiful thermally modified oak
Cool. Yeah. So tell me about thermally modified wood. I have to confess that I'm not up to speed on this. And I have a colleague who's at Greenbuild right now, and brought it up. So what is the thermally modified oak about?
It is effectively like slowly kiln fired, and injected with certain, I'm not exactly sure what the, yeah. You know, I think it might almost be proprietary per manufacturer, resin and or, you know, other oils or what, you know, but it's slowly cooked at a very low heat in a way that makes the wood much more resilient to any sort of rot, mildew, damage, defects. So
got it. So it's,
it makes it more robust. So you yeah. don't really have to finish it. You can also embed a stain. And there are certain companies that are offering warranties on it. So I remember I moved to Philadelphia and we did one of our projects all clad in cedar and someone was like, "You're using wood in the city." And I was like, "I love wood." Don't tell me that. But it was, and masonry has a place in Philadelphia. So but contextually, you know, there are moments when it's just softer and
right.
more gentle. Right. And so this was one of those moments, because immediately when we walked down the street, we were like, this is not, you know, we're not in the city anymore. You know,
it's
like
a really special little pocket.
Yeah. There. Yeah. And it's more, it's like more special in person. Like
I bet.
Really like covered and this is a cart street with very few homes on it. Because on one side is all through lots, which are very deep. So it's really just backyards on one side and then the park and a couple of houses at the end of it. It's, you know, like a home for many species of animals. It's like you hear birds all over. So it's really feels very much like a respite from kind of the horns and, you know, motorcycles and all that. So it seemed suitable. Wood seems suitable
right,
here.
right. So thermally modified wood is like is Shosugiban. Right. From Japan is an example of that. Yeah. So it's using heat to modify the wood so that it's more resilient. That's helpful.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's like truly a chemical change in mm-hmm. the wood. So it really is much more resilient. Yeah. So we did a number of tests and they ended up going with an oak, which I'm excited about, you know,
yeah.
it's beautiful. And then a corrugated metal, and they've really, I won't say we fought over, but we like really work through the details a lot in the office, you know, like lots of trays. And they've really executed them better than we could have imagined. So it's a really pretty project. I can't wait to have it photographed.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, that's a good segue into this question of design. If you still have time to chat.
Okay.
So, you mentioned the first project, when you were at school learning about it from your colleague and it being the first example of, you know, a really well designed, well put together, beautiful building. The first Passifoss I experienced was also really beautiful. It's the Karuna House in Oregon, designed by Holst Architecture. There are, you know, all sorts of kinds of passive houses, which is wonderful. And the Fiascon, at Fiascon, we just had the design competition awards. And I was really struck by the fact that in every single category, there's really, really stunning work happening now. So I guess I have two questions. The first is how the experience of the Northern Liberties project, how you see that perhaps impacting your design work moving forward. maybe it will, maybe it won't, but you know, will it? And if so, how? And then just any other ideas about reflections on Passive House, kind of the constraints that Passive House puts on the designer. And of course, we know constraints can be a source of all sorts of creativity and interesting solutions. So then where is that kind of, where do you see that nexus between really good design and Passive House buildings? So just, I don't know, these are kind of big questions, but I'd love to hear your reflection. You reflect on them. Yeah.
So firstly, I think the impact that the project will have on our work is that we'll feel more confident bringing this to the table as like a baseline and an option. I mean, that's kind of mm-hmm. an obvious answer.
Yeah, no.
But
not necessarily. You could be, oh my God, it was terrifying. I'm not going to do it again.
No, I think we will absolutely. I mean,
yeah, that's great.
To me, like I said, just having the experience of walking in and feeling kind of that silence and that serenity, I think it will have an appreciable impact on the space, mm-hmm. right? As I see the kind of the project unfold in terms of the finishes on the interior, I think I will feel more and more compelled to say, this will add value. And that's like what we always, I don't want to say pitch, but that's what we do, is like we add value. Space has so much value, and whether they're, you know, homeowner clients or the house is going to go on the market. I always try and craft a narrative of like, invest in the design. It will add value. It will add value in ways you can't even imagine. Yeah. And so for me, knowing that it will add value, but then stepping into it and in a way I couldn't have imagined, feeling that, mm-hmm. was really cool. Like it was like, wow.
Yeah.
It's real.
Validating.
So now I will feel more confident saying like, this is a really worthwhile option. And, you know, yes, it's going to be an investment. But you know, it's one, you know, you'll sleep better for many reasons, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. you know, like, so I think, that would be the impact it has on the design. I mean, and then also knowing that I think it's the challenges and the kind of the constraints that the service cavity and or like, you know, you know, the HVAC system or the solar panels, for example, have on the space, on the spatial design, actually, you know, are completely surmountable and mm-hmm. end up in service of that kind of overall, like, wow, and investment. So in short, it would be, the impact is that I now see the value of doing it better through experience. Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I will push for that. I will continue. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In terms of like the constraints, I think I always look forward to these moments. I love a duct that you can't hide. It's like, all right, here we are. Like, I think this is the fun stuff. So I think certainly it takes time, but having the opportunity to work through all of the building systems and to be thoughtful about all of the building systems in an initial way, and having, you know, Passive House as a guideline for that, you know, in terms of, you know, the quality and you know, almost as a rubric, like a baseline, that allows us to start to be thoughtful about the space in ways that, you know, might say, well, we're going to just effectively drop all of the ceilings in one space, or we're going to, you know, and allow for air movement underneath and our utilities, or we're going to keep everything out of the walls, right? Or we're going to, so I love the challenges that it brings in terms of the details. Like I'm thinking of like hidden registers or, you know, like beautiful, you know, detailing out a window or, you know, the things that you have to nail during the rough-in in order to make the finished product perfect.
Right.
Like exactly how you want. And having to think through that when you're standing there on site, you know, like where's the window going to live in the cavity, right? Is it here? Is it here? And then having to think, well, not only are we worried about a dew point, we're worried about a shadow analysis, but we're worried about interior trim and we're, you know,
right.
So it's like all of these things kind of harmonically. Like, I think this is where the fun is you know, figuring out a solution that, is elegant and, you know, kind of addresses, you know, certain times we compromise with certain elements and certain things are not able to be compromised, but that, you know, like adequately addresses all of them, but at minimum, is thoughtful about all of them, right? So that's kind of the, that we had a lot of fun working through this kind of detail on this project. And I know we will in the future, you know, be kind of, our ears are peaked to this kind of level of detail now. Which is nice. That's the nice thing about architecture. So you're kind of writing a book with all your experiences, and you can kind of flip back and say, well, you know, or it's always in mind, as you know, you are staring at a window and thinking about all the ways you've done windows and how, and yet it's never the same.
Yeah.
Like it's like a funny, I think about it a lot, because it's so much unlike many other professions where, you know, there's a certain way to do it. There's a certain way it should be done. If we don't do it this way, there will be problems. Or like an art or an artist where it's just kind of unbounded,
right,
free flowing. Right. But we really live in the middle where it's, you know, we're relying on that kind of, cadre of experience to live happily in between those worlds where we're either just being completely performative and not that fun, or being completely, you know, I'm thinking of the French word, au pif.
Sorry, I can't help you. it sounds good though. I'm convinced.
Completely like extemporaneous, you know, like not worried about the consequences, which we can't do. Mm-hmm.
Like blithe or something.
Right. Yeah. And, but there has, so architecture is kind of that interesting, it's that wonderful middle ground where you're, you know, using what you know to build on something and like allow it to be a creative expression.
I thank you for that answer. It was really wonderful. The when I asked it, I was anticipating answers that had to do with like, oh, well, this is how it's impacted the way I, you know, design a space, or you like concrete things about the actual mechanics of design or what you've described is being a designer who is at play, basically. And you have these, these new elements that you get to play with and manipulate in your work and that become part of this system. So there's just like this kind of, you know, the whole analogy with music and composition. So that's, thank you. That was really wonderful.
Sure.
Yeah.
A little long-winded.
No, it's great. I mean, I think, I know you're we should probably wind up this. I don't know if you have anything else you'd like to add before we close up. This has been really great.
No, thank you for having me. I'm excited. I feel very new in this world. And I'm amazed by the depth of technical knowledge that everyone has. So it's exciting for me, to learn and become more and more familiar with, you know, the specific metrics. And like you said, be able to kind of play in and around them. So yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm looking forward to the next physical manifestations of that from you. Yeah. So yeah, it'll be fun to watch.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Lauren.
And that was Lauren Thompson of Lauren Thompson Architects. Is that her firm?
That's right. No, Lauren Thompson Design.
Lauren Thompson Design. Yeah. Sorry.
Yep. No worries.
And previous guest on Passive House Live as well. Great chat and really interesting story. It's amazing how common that we've talked about this before, about the journey from getting into Passive House kind of through lead. And she talked about, you know, doing yeah. lead first and then sort of seeking more. I thought it was really interesting that she'd heard about Passive House with her time in France, but then it wasn't until later in her career when she eventually got trained. And I was thinking about that process. She described it quite well, of taking baby steps towards becoming a Passive House and sort of being close to a Passive House project and then sort of helping out with one and sort of getting closer and closer to then finally actually embarking on being in her case, the architect of that and that whole process. And it kind of made me think that, a lot of other professions, you do your basic training and then you specialize in medicine, you specialize as a, and then you do structured training towards that specialization. Same with engineering, you do basic engineering, and then you might specialize as a structural mechanical and then even in a subcategory within those. And then there's usually some sort of professional development in a structured way to specialize in that area. And I feel like for Passive House, a lot of people, professionals have to feel their own way a little bit and create that pathway for themselves. And certainly there's good training through the various academies and institutions now that are doing either FIERCE training or PHI training, but there's still a lot of on the ground learning that people have to do. And as Lauren described, a lot of the project management and procurement and all those sorts of things that you kind of just, if you don't have someone in your network who's done it before and can show you what they've done, there's a lot of feeling your way and finding that stuff out for yourself. So it kind of reminds me that we still have a lot of people who are pioneers in their own little space and in their own location.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's not really a simple prescribed path to follow to get to where Lauren's at in Passive House Design. And so it probably is attractive right now to folks who are okay with that, you know, are willing to improvise. And I think that was, and I think I mentioned in the conversation with her, but just when I asked about, you know, how Passive House has impacted her practice or her approach to design and things, I was just really struck by that sense of kind of enjoying that all these different variables now that she's playing with.
Yeah.
And it does, you know, not to belabor the improvisation metaphor, but it does, you know, it does feel like a little bit like a jazz musician, you know, and being willing to just be there and kind of interact with all these different elements and not necessarily having like the prescribed piece of sheet music to be following all the time.
I like her use of the word harmony in describing. I think what she was talking about was the technical and the aesthetic. And she described that process as being quite fun, which I think it has to be, because otherwise it can get very complex and just overwhelming. But you know, thinking about how, if you've got an exposed duct, how can you make that, you know, part of the envelope? And I found as an engineer really interesting listening to Lauren speaking as an architect, and that, you know, right back to her 7-year-old creative self of really getting a sense that the aesthetic is important, and that's part of the art of architecture, but also bringing in the function to that form of how it's actually going to perform. And I think that's quite a nice way of describing it, that the skill of a good architect is to create that harmony with all the moving parts.
Yeah. Well said. It's also a really important building typology that she's doing. This, you know, it's on a very narrow piece of land in an existing neighborhood. And so she's figuring out how to create a new dwelling in this tight space that also really works for the neighboring buildings and this sweet little park right next to it. And so
I'm a big fan of row houses, terrace houses, attached houses, whatever they are called locally. I've got way too many photos of those types of houses from walking around the streets of Chicago when I was there. And I'm fascinated by how they can be designed to be appealing, because they're in places like Auckland and a lot of Australia and New Zealand, there's a mentality of a sort of Californian style bungalow where you've got your own house and you've got your lawn around that and your fence, and then your neighbors are a little way away. But there are places all throughout Europe and in the middle of cities where more compact houses are really, really desirable and beautiful places to be, and quite expensive. You know, it's attractive real estate, and there's sort of an X factor that makes that happen. You can't just smush a whole bunch of houses together and for them to be immediately appealing. There's something that I haven't quite. There's probably a bunch of things that have to come together to make that the case, but. I find it really fascinating as we grow, as cities grow, and we have pressure on housing affordability and also don't want to keep sprawling out into new green space. I think it's really important that we figure out how to do more dense housing, but in an attractive, healthy way.
I couldn't agree more. As we have more and more density, good design becomes critically important to avoid backlash. I mean, just this goes back a little ways, but in a previous life when I was advocating for, you know, progressive regional planning in Portland, Oregon, there were a bunch of row houses that were being built at that time that people derided as snout houses. Because they were essentially snout houses, because they looked like, because they were squished together, as you say, and all you could see was this ugly garage door in front of each one of them. It was horrible, horrible design. And neighbors were mad, you know, and they blamed density. But the problem was horrible design. And also, you know, this auto-oriented problem that we have in the United States. But I think, you know, that was kind of a really important lesson, I think, for me early on, of just like how important good design is in creating sustainable cities. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we don't have to have like, you know, it's just like good fundamental, there's some fundamentals that you say, and I don't know, I think you're right, there's an X factor there but some of well, it's I think, obvious. I think not, don't put garages in front of everyone.
Well, yeah, designing around the people, not cars, is a good place to start.
That's right. That's right.
And when I think of famous terrace homes like in Bath in the UK and in London, there's no garages.
No, exactly. It's all
off-street park. Yeah, off-street parking may be a problem, but that's another that's different solutions for that. With regards to size, I wouldn't consider 1800 square feet as tiny.
I guess
it's relative. Lauren did mention tiny house in a tiny section. Not tiny in the sort of modern definition of or the movement of tiny homes. So that equates to about 167 square meters, which is that's definitely small for a three bedroom house. But certainly comfortable.
Yes, definitely. It does have a very small footprint because it's multi-story. That's a good point. It's not a tiny house.
And speaking of numbers, 0.038 CFM.
Yes.
0.038. That's going to confuse a lot of people.
Yeah. So let's break it down. So maybe we'll start in our units here in the US. So 0.038 cubic feet per minute per square foot at 50 pascals. So this is an air permeance rating. That is the way that the FIA standard measures air tightness. And so the air tightness requirement for FIA buildings, so this is different from the the 0.6 ACH at 50 pascals of the PHI certification, which is about volume of air. This is about the volume of the building. This is a focus on the permeance of a square foot of the envelope of the building. So that's the difference. So the standard for FIA certification is you need to be at or below 0.06 CFM per square foot at 50 pascals. So 0.038 is significantly better than 0.06. So it was a great result. Just as a note, there's a prescriptive standard that FIAS has unveiled in the last year or two. And for the prescriptive standard, it needs to be at or below 0.04. So it still would meet the prescriptive standard as well.
And for those of us in the rest of the world, converting that to a metric equivalent is slightly challenging because, it can be done because the equivalent metric is cubic meters per square meter. So you're measuring the amount of the volume. You're still measuring the volume of air that flows through a square meter of the surface area of the building envelope, as opposed to the number of air changes per hour. So, interestingly, for a fairly standard single story house, around about sort of 180 to 200 square meters, I think 0.6 ACH, so 0.6 air changes, is roughly equivalent to 0.6 cubic meters per square meter. But to be able to convert that to an equivalent, you need to know the square meterage of the surface area of the building. So you can't do a simple permeability to ACH without knowing the surface area of the building. And that's kind of the point, because ACH does favor larger buildings. It's very hard to get below 0.6 on a very, very small house, because you're getting that more frequent changes of the total volume inside the building. So that's one of the reasons why FIAS use the permeance metric, is that it's sort of deemed to be more fair across a larger range of building sizes and also shapes.
Yeah, good point. I should also point out that 0.06 requirement is for buildings that are under five stories high.
Right.
So for five stories and up, the requirement is 0.08.
Right.
I'll include a link in the notes to the FIA certification guidebook so that people can look at these numbers themselves.
Yeah. And I'll see if I can figure out an easy way to convert that to sensible numbers.
Good luck.
Awesome. All right. Great interview. Thank you for that. We got some events coming up.
We do. So we are on Wednesday, November 30th. So December 1st for you in New Zealand and Auckland, or in New Zealand and Australia, pardon me. We are having a Passive House Accelerator Live program entitled Building Passive House on Spec During a Pandemic and in a Weird Market. So I think lots of folks can relate to this. This will be with the Langloy Eco Homes team. I apologize. I'm probably totally screwing up that pronunciation, but it's a team from Ontario, Canada. We're really looking forward to this. So please join us for Passive House Accelerator Live. And then coming up, we have episode 3 of the Urban Passive House series that we're doing in partnership with New York Passive House. And so this is December 8th at noon Eastern. So that's going to be December 9th for you, Matthew, quite early in the morning. We're going to be joined by Michael Syracuse of FX Collaborative, and he will be speaking about the Reuben Hall retrofit in New York City, which is this really cool old, looks like it's probably 12 stories, brick building in New York. So please join us for that. And we'll have links to other goings on in the Passive House world in the show notes as well.
Right. Awesome. And don't forget to sign up to Passive House Accelerator newsletter so that you get all those dates and more, plus reminders of what's coming up on Passive House Live and various other events. And we'll be back again next week on Passive House Podcast.